you go along to a magic convention and you see, you know, people who are talking about different ways of doing effects and so on, you could interpret a lot of that, right, is this kind of contest about who can speak for lay audience. We have this difficulty. The more we learn about our trade and how it's done, the less we're able to relate to our audiences. We get more and more removed from how they're experiencing it.
Have you ever thought about how magicians learn their tricks? I don't mean the methods, the smoke and mirror behind the illusion, but the actual process of learning a new effect. Even magicians don't think that much about learning magic, treating our instructions and magic books like a recipe that, if followed, will create a moment of wonder somewhere down the track. Brian Rappert, a professor of science, technology and public affairs at the University of Exeter, believes there's more to learning magic than just following the directions. Starting as a complete novice, he's documented the process of becoming a magician, not to reveal the secrets, but to understand the process by which a magician acquires their skills. In this episode of Scammapalooza, Brian goes deep into his research exploring the nature of learning magic. Now be warned, we do go deep into this topic, and we also discuss certain Christmas-related secrets that may be inappropriate for very young listeners. That's your first and only warning. If you enjoy the episode today, why not share it with a friend? Word of mouth is the only way people find out about these things. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. Obviously, I've spoken to a lot of authors, and every time I speak to an author, they come from a place of being an expert on a subject. They reach a point in their career where they know perhaps more than most people on a particular topic and decide, yes, I'm going to sit down and research and write a book. You've written a book on the art of performing and learning magic, but you were not a magician. You came up with the idea for the book and then purposely avoided magic until you were ready to begin the project. Why was that your starting position with this project?
Thanks for that as a question, because it opens up so many reasons why I got into magic and why I wrote the book that I did. My inspiration, I talk a little bit about in the book, but I mean, it goes back to the early 2000s. And I happened to see a show where someone was performing, a magician, and he basically wanted to kind of theme that around the paranormal and how people get taken in by, you know, people who are pretending to have powers that they don't. And the way that, you know, that the way that event went is he basically came out and said, okay, look, I'm going to show you how people can, you know, pretend to have powers which they don't possess. And so he did lots of effects for us and so on. And we had a little intermission, and he came back and he said, no, I didn't do it that way. I did all the effects this way. And without, you know, making too much of a fuss about it, the point I took away, right, is that anyone could be fooled, including, you know, a nice grouping of people who came out to learn about how other people get fooled. Yeah. So he kind of did to us what he said other people did to unsuspecting audiences. And I found that so interesting. That was a long time ago now. Gosh, so it's kind of back to 20 years ago almost. And I was just so inspired by that event, you know. I mean, so many magicians, you know, get inspired by something, right? So something happens to them, and they kind of get the bug. And I got the bug then, but I knew, right, if it would be a long time before if I just took up magic. I mean, you know, it's a long process, right?
Yeah.
And you got to do it properly. And I was busy as a postdoc at the time. I was working on, you know, kind of various projects, and I had other things on my mind. So anyway, I said I want to do this, and I want to do it properly. And the way I'm going to do it is I want to do this study about how do you learn magic, right? How do you kind of take it up in the first place? And my thinking for that was that some fields sometimes, right, the idea that someone comes in as a beginner, You know, they come in, they're able to see things that, that people who are in the field for a long time can't see. And so I kind of took up this idea, like, I could study learning magic, because I'm interested in learning, you know, as a, as an academic. And I could apply it to myself. And this would be a way of me learning about magic, but then also being able to write about it from a position which maybe, you know, you could say had some strengths to it, just because I'm coming from the outside. So yeah, so it took me a long time to get around to it.
Well,
15
I mean,
years
you
later
were busy.
Or whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, looking at what you have spent the last 20 years doing, you haven't exactly been sitting around like you do. And I guess when I say that you came to it without knowing the subject matter, you certainly you're a researcher is your and particularly related to science and technology and public affairs, and just looking at your previous research, it's weapons, biological weapons, you know, data, police and evidence. It, at first glance, it doesn't seem to have a lot to do with magic, but that the themes of obviously secrets, who gets to know what and when and how and the effects of that on people is there. And also, I guess, the idea of how we learn that information and how we learn those new skills, that is something that's come across in your research before. So would it be fair to say it's a continuation of your previous research?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when I thought of taking up the magic topic, you know, recently, I thought I'd get into it. I imagined that at that stage, the whole issue of secrecy would be important for me because, as you alluded to there, it's something I've studied. I've been interested in diplomacy. I've been interested in conflict and war and the control and management of information. And I thought, okay, so I'm going to go into this and I'm going to think about how do magicians, you know, talk about their methods and what do they share between themselves and the rest of it. And, you know, as it turned out, it was interesting, right? Because of course that is something that, you know, that's a theme within magic. But I just wasn't as interested in that as a theme as a lot of other topics that came up. And, you know, the topics that came up for me, I mean, a lot of it was just about the kind of practicalities of learning magic. I think it's really interesting, magic as a field, right? We learn through magic that our perception, our memory, our reasoning, you know, they're fallible in lots of ways. I mean, this is kind of the human condition, right? And yet, you know, it's through those, you know, through our very kind of perception, memory, and reasoning that we're able to learn magic. So I think it's, you know, it's just fascinating as a field. As you become more skilled, you become to realize more and more about the limits of your perception. And I think that's, you know, that happens maybe in some other areas, but it's just so central to magic. And or it was is to my experience of it. And so that's the sort of thing I became fascinated with. This question of more the kind of, yeah, the kind of nitty gritty of learning that takes place.
And it seemed to that one of the first things that you came up against, and I think all people learning magic come up against the same challenges, but you were definitely able to articulate them better than most. It's not just that idea of, oh, how do I create the perception of magic? But that's that idea that you talked about of, oh, there's my perception of what this is supposed to look like versus what it actually does look like to someone else. And also just your perception of yourself as someone who is now, for example, performing sleight of hand. You sort of no longer see what you're doing as magic. You see it as a series of mechanical, highly practiced movements that you then have to kind of hide in order to create that perception. And that tension between all these different types of perception seems to come through the book a lot. How did you find a way as a magician, I guess, to be able to reconcile that tension between all the different ways in which we perceive magic and ourselves and our audience perceive us?
No.
Right. Oh, well, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. It's been a pleasure. And the book is
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, right? So, I mean, I suppose my attitude has been trying to find more and more ways of getting into the tensions of knowing the tensions of experience. So, you know, as you kind of mentioned there, and you know, as many magicians talk about, right? I mean, we have this difficulty. The more we learn about our trade and how it's done, the less we're able to relate to our audiences who, you know, we talk about just whatever kind of lay audiences and the way in which magicians tend to talk about lay audiences. I mean, we get more and more removed from how they're experiencing it. And it's just fascinating for me as someone who's interested in expertise, you know, from a more academic level, who is an expert? How is expertise defined? Because, you know, if you go along to a magic convention and you see, you know, people who are talking about different ways of, you know, doing effects and so on, I mean, you could interpret a lot of that, right? Is this kind of contest about who can speak for lay audiences? Okay, what counts as a powerful effect? Is this whatever? Is this trick better than that one? Why should I listen to what you're saying? You know? I have my own experience. Yeah. And so there's a lot of desire for magicians to be expert, but often that involves their expertise as a claim to being able to experience the world as a novice to magic. And so that's just, I mean, that's just like, you know, for whatever, for an academic. I mean, it's just fascinating terrain, right? So, you know, you're in a magic convention, people are talking about what they do, and everyone's trying to kind of position themselves in this kind of space of, I don't know anything. I can see as somebody who doesn't know anything about magic. And so how do you do that convincingly? I mean, it's a really interesting area where these questions about expertise play out. So for me, I mean, I think there are just, you know, kind of pervasive tensions, right? And one of the tensions is about knowing the other. What is the audience thinking? And, you know, of course, you know, we can devise scientific experiments, and there's a whole science of magic, you know, which is covered on your website, and you know, I'm part of that as well. But still, you know, I mean, there's a lot of questions about how audiences perceive magic. And I suppose, oh, sorry.
No, I was just gonna, yeah, that idea that you again, you come back to a few times in the book. It's that idea that magic is something that is very much performed. It's a practice that's performed with the audience, even if the audience is just sitting there watching, like they might a movie. That magic doesn't work unless the audience member is a sort of an active participant, even if that's not necessarily physical. And yet, as you mentioned in the book, there's at the same time, in order for that to work, we need to be separate from them and have information that we're not giving them. And so it's this real paradox that I've never sort of seen described so succinctly, that idea of you want to get right inside somebody's head and really have them on board on a real deep sort of psychic level, and yet at the same time, keep them at arm's length in terms of what they know and what they don't know.
And you know, this relation between the stories we tell and, you know, whatever the kind of hidden methods, I mean, that's there in magic in a way in which, you know, it isn't so much in other fields. I mean it's there in lots of pursuits, but it's pretty apparent in the case of magic. And I guess for me, I mean, you know, come back to the question you asked, you know, or the issue you raised at the start about, you know, positioning myself as a beginner and basically learning from scratch. And you know, one of the things I found very interesting learning from scratch is just how hard it was to get, let me say it this way, honest feedback from my audience about how the magic was going. Because, you know, as a learner, as a beginner, right, you can't but help get better, right? There are so many ways in which it's necessary. And yet, you know, when I started off, you know, I started off like a lot of people. I practiced for friends and colleagues and so on. In my case, you know, I recorded those practice sessions because, you know, I was interested in kind of trying to systematically reflect on them. But in any case, I mean, in those sessions, I mean, very hard to get people to say, "Ooh, why don't you do this or that?" Or, "Oh, I didn't like this," or, "I didn't like that." You know, just this whole way in which audiences kind of go along with these performances. And I find it very difficult to know what people are thinking. I know the audiences are trying to make me feel good about the event, about what we're doing together. This is social life. Social life, we're often engaged in these kind of cooperative acts where we're just trying to smooth things out and just make sure no one, you know, in the situation feels awkward, not the person you're speaking to, not yourself, right? And one of the ways in which we do that is just to not be offer kind of negative thing comments that could be construed as negative.
In order to appear like a good audience for magic, people will want to appear fooled. They want to appear amazed. But there's a difference between appearing amazed and actually being amazed. And so I think sometimes audiences, you know, I know how it was done, but he did it very well, is not the same thing as I am amazed by this miracle in front of me.
Yeah. But even much more subtle things, you know, just... the choice of effects we have, whether we're holding the cards at a proper angle so they can kind of see what's happening, or you know, whatever the effect is. I mean, there's gotta be all sorts of ways in which, you know, as someone who's now been doing this for whatever it is, four years or so, right? I mean, come on, I there's gotta be all sorts of ways in which I can improve what I do, and yet, you know, trying to extract that from audiences. And my performances are basically kind of like focus groups, right? I get people talking. I get people talking about what we're doing. But it's really hard. you know, I think there are a lot of magicians. I mean, like, Darren Brown, you know, I mean, he's written very eloquently about, you know, the difficulty of knowing the audience. And, I very much kind of subscribe to that. Because it's a cooperative activity in magic, you know, it can be because they're, you know, maybe they, you know, they don't want to be around us and they just want to get out of the place as quickly as possible. But yeah. A lot of times it is about because they want the thing to move along.
The magician Simon Coronel, who recently won the close up at FISM, has a book. It's more of a booklet called The Institute of Layman Studies, and basically what he's tried to do is to get those sorts of answers that you're talking about. So created an exercise where he performs a trick for an effect for a layperson, and he has a second layperson standing behind them looking in the other direction, so they can't see what's happening. And so as Simon is performing the routine, he has the first layperson describe what is happening to the other person, and he says, just describe what you see. And he can, in having someone describe what you're doing, you begin to pick up the sort of hidden information that they're not even aware of themselves, or information they may not see as important about the nature of what they're actually perceiving.
Yeah, wonderful. That's fascinating. I'm definitely going to get a hold of that, and it sounds like he's worked out some really interesting techniques for trying to speak with these unruly people, the audience members.
Was that something? I mean, you talk about sort of the difficulty in becoming better as a magician. What was that part of your goal? Was to, I guess, improve the learning of magic, or was it? Because the impression I get was more that you were, I guess, trying to explore and record and discover what it is to learn magic, as opposed to kind of trying to improve the process. Would that be fair, or were you sort of out to make it a more efficient process, like Simon has?
Well, I mean, my goals at the start, as far as my contribution to magic, were pretty modest, and they're still pretty modest because you know, as one gets into this field, I mean, you realize the sheer, you know, effort and ingenuity that many people have put into the art of conjuring for you know, whatever, many decades, right, centuries, and I am still. You know, amazed. I go around to magic conventions and, you know, even card magic, which is the area that the medium I tend to work in, right? I mean, I am still awed by some performers. So it's just such a vast area that, you know, people have explored. So in a sense, I mean, you know, I'm kind of, you know, able to kind of see myself for what I am, which is still very much a beginner, even if I've been doing this for a few years. I mean, my own aspiration is to, I guess I see magic as a method. I approach it as a method. It's a method for getting to know ourselves. It's a method for getting to know other people. It's a kind of way of structuring a social interaction. And, you know, it has its own kind of ways of probing and issues that it raises. Just like, you know, I don't know, if you were to do a survey or do an interview with people. I mean, I'm a social researcher, so, you know, this is kind of the mentality under which I'm approaching this. So what I'm thinking of doing now is, you know, I want to bring magic into education, teach at a university. And, you know, there are a lot of questions about how you would do that. How do you combine magic with messages? And I think, you know, some of the, I mean, there has been research on this for sure, but I think, you know, it's still in a kind of merging area. And I don't know that there's, you know, there's a lot of work that's taking place, but there aren't necessarily all that many kind of studies. So as a next phase of what I'm doing, I mean, you know, I've got a plan now for just some very simple experiments about, you know, if you want to talk about secrecy, say, social scientists like me are interested in secrecy, how do you do that? How can you do that through magic? How would you integrate effects in with some sort of discussion, some sort of messages you wanted to put out about secrecy? So, you know, that's, you know, one thing I got now is some initial ideas and some plans about trying to, you know, put some videos together, test them out with audiences, you know, and just answer some, I don't know, some, or let's say address some very basic questions about how magic can be used as part of education.
Historically, magic and education has been almost entirely metaphorical, in the sense of the magic is a metaphor for an idea, and it's essentially, I'm going to hang an idea onto the trick, because, you know, onto the props or the items, and you will hopefully remember, because the magic is so memorable, you will remember the facts. So it's a sort of straight transfer, kind of the empty vessel of education. I think of gospel magic, you know, the idea, there's always people talking about handkerchiefs representing the blood of Christ and so on, and it's not particularly inspiring in that format.
Yeah. I mean, so there's lots of different ways to think about magic and education. I mean, one of them is just, hey, you know, let me get your attention. Woof. Okay, now that I have your attention through this effect, and your curiosity has piqued, now I'll tell you about something else. But there's also, as you mentioned, the kind of illustrative functions of magic, where you can, you kind of project on some meanings onto the props and so on. I mean, there is a more, exemplifying model. So maybe you can do some experiments around physics and so on, you know, through magic, and just illustrate that the world is, you know, the physical world operates in kinds of strange ways. And there's definitely people who've done a lot of, you know, interesting work along those lines. Yeah, I guess for me, I mean, in terms of the magic that I've done to date, one of the ways in which I've set up my performances is they are very much discussion-based. I think I mentioned in the past, they're kind of focus groups. And what I'm interested in asking audience members in those interactions is about how they're interacting in the scene. So I will ask people about why they're challenging me or not, right? Most time people don't kind of let the magician get on, but sometimes not, right? So that's one area where I want them to reflect as we're doing this thing together on what they're doing, right? And that kind of changes what the event is, what we're accomplishing together, because we're able to kind of reflect on it. I mean, one of the most interesting things I found in doing my magic is, you know, very early on, I just started asking people, well, how do you think this was done? You know, just to see what they said. And what I found, you know, interesting about that is that always, I mean, I must have asked that question, I don't know, 60 times, 70 times, I mean, I don't know. And always, right, it's about me as the performer. What am I doing? Maybe on occasion, you might get someone actually saying something along the lines of, well, we're being fooled, right? So somehow the audience gets kind of placed into the answer somehow. But it's amazing, right? I mean, people don't see themselves, audience members don't see themselves as part of the performance. And I think it's just fascinating. And it goes back to a long-standing, you know, set of issues in, I don't know, whatever. I mean, you know, Western culture, right? I mean, the distinctions between audiences, you know, audiences are passive, performers are active, right? There's this split taking place. We're here, we're watching you, you know, I mean, yeah, these kind of longstanding kind of dichotomies that it exists in lots of areas of performance. And, you know, part of what I want to do is just challenge those. And I want to say, no, look, I mean, magic is more like telling a joke, right? If you tell a joke and no one's there, it's not really clear you've told a joke. You've done something, but, you know, and magic needs an audience. And so, you know, in the public shows I do, what I want to do is I want to raise a question, okay, how is it that we're doing this together? Right? So it has that kind of what academics like me would call reflexive level to it, right? Where we're reflecting back on what we're doing as we're doing it. And that's the kind of interaction that I want to get going. Through my work, because I want people to think about the everyday life and how we get along with one another, right? And magic is a method for having that reflection.
Do you find people? I mean, obviously, it's people's not their natural instinct to reflect as audience members. Do you find when you push them to reflect, do you find them then willing to actually be more involved on that level? Or is there a sort of, do the walls often come down and people become defensive? Because I do find magic is quite, you know, despite being card tricks and rabbits out of hats, is quite a confronting thing for a lot of people to see, to feel like they've been manipulated, to feel like they're not quite in control. And asking people to reflect on that, I imagine for some people might be a little difficult.
Yeah. I mean, it is hard to know how difficult it is, but I can say that people do respond in terms of the interactions. And some of those responses, you know, people will have said, okay, well, you know, you said pick a card, any card, but I presume that you know, I don't know, you didn't want me to pick those cards over there or those on those edges, so I picked one over here because I thought that's what I was supposed to, you know. And so you get that kind of articulation of the thought processes that are going on for people as they're participating. Because what they're recounting there is they are actively trying to help the effect along, right? They're trying to do what they need to do, you know, in this interaction to make it work. And so often in life, right, we bump into someone on the street. I don't know, you know, maybe we're in a setting like, you know, an educational setting like this one, or we're at work, or, you know, wherever it is, right? I mean, we are trying to get, you know, we are in interactions where we're basically, you know, we're trying to make sure that we're making this thing happen. And through that, you know, no one is made to look silly or foolish or to feel, you know, they are, they're being sort of overly scrutinized in some way. I mean, yeah, so much of social life is about getting on with other people. And that applies to a lot of areas, right? I mean, we think about when we tell the truth, when does the truth matter? And there's all sorts of interactions, you know, where, you know, we set aside questions about whether something's true or not. If you speak to someone on the street and you say, how are you doing, right? I mean, you're not necessarily expecting some true account, right? This is just part of kind of the kind of, I don't know, the lubricant of of kind of getting on in life, right? So yeah, I mean, for me, you know, I'm trying to position magic, and I'm trying to position the deception that audiences anticipate as part of magic, you know, as a kind of basis for then asking these questions, you know, about kind of social life more generally. And hopefully by them, you know, seeing that I'm just trying to be playful through deception, you know, maybe, right, that's the hope. It creates a space for them to talk about, what's going on, whatever, in the back of their minds as we're doing the magic together. And, you know, it happens, and, you know, some sessions are interactive and lots of discussions, and, you know, some less. So, you know, definitely need to keep working on this question of how to kind of draw people into a conversation.
You mentioned cooperation briefly there, and I was very excited to see that you mentioned Paul Grice's cooperative principle in the book briefly. And I had never thought to apply that to magic. And the tension that brings, because Paul Grice says that in a cooperative discourse, that of the many sort of rules we set for ourselves and each other, that we do expect the other person to tell the truth, and magic fundamentally relies on at least one of the people lying and the other person knowing that that person is lying. And it does really turn that principle on its head. It's not just a violation of that maxim of tell the truth, because you know the other person is lying, you want them to lie, but you don't want to know the details of the lie. And so it really does create a tension there that is difficult for both audience and magician alike.
Yeah, and it's wonderful that space can be playful, right? You know, whether or not you intend it or not, you can get into this I'm fooling you kind of dynamic. You know, which of course a lot of magicians, you know, warn against. But isn't magic a huge space for having this this playfulness about how we are with one another? And you know, I mean, as somebody who's interested in deception and social life, right? I mean, it's not just magic, right? Just magic. Yes. Where people are deceiving each other, and maybe even where people are deceiving each other with a certain kind of you know, an idea that there's a certain care, okay, to what takes place in the deception. You know, if you're having to look after someone who's ill, I mean, for instance, you know, I've been reading a lot for various reasons about dementia. You know, how do you interact with, how do you relate the truth to for people who are having, you know, having let's say alternative kind of experiences than the rest of us, right? And in a lot of cases of health and illness, you know, maybe there's a way in which we kind of skirt around issues of truth, and you know, we're often deceptive, you know, in social life, because we're trying to kind of protect other people, or we're trying to be, you know, trying to look out for their feelings. But then you can map that onto just, you know, I mean, you know, in terms of where my research is going, you know, one of the things I'm interested in doing in the future that I really want to study is the whole kind of, you know, like Father Christmas or Santa Claus, you know, depending on where your listeners are coming from or whatever, as a kind of cultural phenomenon, you know. I mean, lots of, you know, parents around the world lying to their children, right? This whole kind of cultural industry that's built around this kind of deception.
As someone who does this for a living, so, you know, spends my days steeped in deception, whether it's as a magician or talking about con artists and scams and so on, I value the truth very highly, particularly when it comes to my own kids, and I don't like lying to them. I don't, you know, I'll play with them, and I will. But if I think I may have said something and they believe something that is untrue, I'm always quick to clarify and make sure they know. And I avoid lying, particularly lies of convenience about, oh no, that shop's shut today or whatever it is. but yeah, you know. But when it comes to Santa Claus, I am in 100%, and it feels vaguely hypocritical to sort of, you know, like to be a part of this grand. This grand conspiracy.
Yeah. So it's interesting, right? So the question then is like, why are some forms of deception, you know, permissible and others not? And why are some kind of seen as beneficial, right? And some not. Mm. And why are some have a mutuality to them? I mean, that's the thing with magic, right? I mean, you know, I mean, it should be for, you know, it should be for the audience should get something out of it. We as magicians, you know, should kind of get something out of it.
So let's talk tricks. I mean, I found myself nodding at your choice of magic, and oh yes, you're going to start with some self-working card tricks from Carl Fuse. Oh yes, good. That's an excellent book. Was it just this is a good place to start as a beginner, or this is what I'm interested in, or was there a more academic reason for starting where you did.
Yeah, that was a suggestion that came from an academic and a magician whose name is Wally Smith, who's a fellow compatriot of yours. He's at Melbourne, and I've known him for a while, just on my other academic interests. And you know, I had a chance because I waited so long before taking up magic to just, you know, kind of float that idea out to many people. And Wally was really responsive and really supportive. And yeah, he was the one that suggested coming up with the self-working, you know, looking at self-working books first. And my, you know, what a good choice it ended up being, because I got to then start with this in some sense, right? In some sense, very kind of individual exercise. I could sit down at my desk. I had a book. I read the instructions. I was then able to think about what does it mean to enact these instructions? How do I move from what's written on the page to, you know, some sort of, you know, doing right with my hands or you know, whatever it was. You know, as I talk about in the book, right? I mean, so often in magic, right, we're trying to see from or trying to experience from the position of another, right? So it wasn't just an individual exercise. Like, you know, there's this fascinating way, even when you just sit at a table, right? You're kind of evoking all these people who might be seeing what you're doing and trying to understand, would this work, right? Would this be meaningful for people? How would you understand that? Can I really go with these instructions? Like, yeah, some, you know, some instructions, like, you know, I read and I'm just like, no, I'm never going to do that. So, you know, you're always making these choices of interpretation and you know, formal written descriptions are never exhaustive of what you need to do in a situation. So there's always this, you know, there's always this way in which we have to bring something to written out instructions. We have to make them into something real. So yeah, the working with the some of the, you know, the initial self-working books provided a very, you know, a way for me to engage with lots of different themes, but in a manner that was fairly sort of, you know, still kind of controlled and bounded. And it was me in a room, you know, just, you know, doing this kind of reflection. And you also realize the power of the self-working tricks too. Again, you know, as magicians, right? I mean, lots of ways in which, you know, we think about skill and what counts as skillful and what audiences are going to appreciate and what sort of effects we want to do. And, you know, we have all sorts of presumptions about that. And what I was able to learn through, you know, my own kind of selection of doing self-working card tricks, which is what I did for, you know, a long time, is just, you know, the power they can have and the way in which, you know, yeah, our brains and, you know, our sense making, right? It can be short circuited through something very simple. So, you know, your key card trick, which I talk about one key card trick in the book for a long time.
Yes, I have never been so for something that is just, you know, in every magic book that I've ever, you know, like kids magic book, I have never been so entranced by the key card trick. It was like this the insight you had into that was extraordinary. Amazing.
It was just so lovely for me to have that as the first card trick I learned, because it was basically, you know, first page of the first book was, you know, a basic kind of key card trick. And but right, our minds, you know, I mean people should be able we should be able to notice this. I should have, you know, I kind of feel like I should be able to figure out how that's done, you know. When you read the kind of initial instructions about what was going to happen, you're like, how? That's impossible.
Yes, right,
we kind of think one way. We have a kind of topology, right, in our minds about cards and how they work, and just this simple act of cutting the cards and what that entails, and now the bottom card is, you know, is on what used to be the top card, and on that basis, right, we can do so much in magic, but our human minds just, you know, I mean, of course, some people can figure out how something like a simple key card trick is done, but I didn't. You know, initially, and it just amazed me, and it just wowed me over. And I mean, I've rarely had anyone call out even a very, you know, kind of simple effect based on that kind of principle. I mean, it can happen, but
You talked about the way in which you talk about learning in those early chapters in the book is as rather than just following the instructions and being that to learn the trick is not just to mechanically do what it says in the instructions, but there is, I can't remember your exact phrasing, but you describe it as almost like a sort of moment of discovery where you sort of start doing what the author has told you to do, you know, deal down the cards and bring this over here. And there's sort of a moment of discovery where you realize what you're supposed to discover essentially about how this trick actually works. And that it made me think a lot. I find it often with, I like origami. And when you're folding origami and there's a point where you're going, I don't see how this is supposed to going to be a frog. And there's a moment where you go, oh, I see. Yes, a frog, of course. This is what I'm making. I understand this instruction. I understand how it is. It's sort of coming into being. And I thought that was a really nice way of thinking about learning new skills. It's not about being a robot following programming, but rather having these kind of tiny little mini epiphanies as you discover what the author is trying to get you to discover.
Yeah, it's wonderful, right? Because so many times in magic, when we're in some sort of context of a learning environment, what you'll have is the magician does the effect, you know, and then you're like, whoa, and then they break it down, right? And then kind of go through the methods for it. And at some stage, there's that kind of moment of things kind of clicking, right? And you're in this very active learner position where you're trying to, you know, okay, I've got this little piece and maybe I have some ideas for how this could be done, but I'm kind of like, I need to see them all. And you're like, oh no, it's just it's a rough and smooth deck or whatever, right? Or, you know, whatever the thing turns out to be. And it's like, ah, yeah, okay. Yeah. And I just love that moment so much. And what I do in the book is, yeah, I briefly, but I then, you know, I try to compare different kind of ways of presenting effects. And, you know, sometimes magic isn't broken down in that kind of way. So, you know, one of the descriptions I look at is just, yeah, do this, do this, do this, do this. And, you know, the numbers work out such that, at the end, yes. You know, there's some exhaustive process that I'm sure the audience is completely bored with, that is their card. And such a different kind of learning experience. So, I mean, I think definitely, you know, it's possible to look through instructions for magic effects and you know, systematize, you know, classify them and say, you know, what kind of learning is involved in these. And maybe, right, like, I don't know, maybe people have done this, but maybe, you know, maybe as a community, we could think about, okay, well, what ways of expression, what kinds of, you know, what kinds of forms of presentation are most, you know, most effective at conveying how to do something in terms of the methods, which are maybe right, which are able to, then people are able to pick up as quickly as possible. I don't know. I mean, it just strikes me there's all sorts of ways that magicians have developed for describing what they do. But I haven't seen anyone kind of, you know, try to lay out that and try to think, okay, for different kinds of effects, what different kind of descriptions. Yeah.
A lot of it does appear to be market driven, in the sense of, so, you know, magic is obviously magicians create magic and then they sell it to other magicians and the people who are really good at it are not selling to professional magicians, they're selling to amateur magicians. And it feels like often what they're selling is not a good trick, but or a good routine or a good effect, but rather that moment of discovery, of learning, of that learning how it works and why it works and being that discovery. And the effect itself might not actually be that strong, but because of perhaps the method or the way in which it's taught or that moment of discovery, people will buy it because that's actually what they're buying. You know, that's what they actually want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think a lot of that comes around to issues of identity and, you know, how magicians are presenting themselves. I mean, the, you know, the those people, you know, really good on YouTube or popular and all the rest of it. I mean, they're selling more than magic, right? I mean, they're selling a sense of they're not just selling some methods, right? They're selling a sense of kind of who they are as people. And I think it's a really interesting topic as well, because I think it relates to then this question about how we learn magic. And for me, I mean, the magician I'm kind of most inspired by is Danny DeOrtez. And, you know, I don't have his bubbly personality. I'm not able to. I mean, who is, right? Who's able to? But you learn so much from imitating someone. And, you know, when do they turn? You know, where are they pointing? Why are they laughing at this stage? You know, now he's saying, but, and why is he? There's so much to learn about how effects get done that are beyond just the methods, right? And for me, you know, it's just been a lesson in this, all the very difficult to convey or even know, kind of performance points that you learn by watching other magicians and really for me, I mean, kind of trying to imitate them in some way. You have to figure out what that way is. It's not necessarily going to be in trying to be like them as a person, but the mannerisms and just, you know, a lot of the gesturing that goes on. I mean, it's all so subtle and very hard to describe in a written account.
So in the last 20 years, while obviously there's a huge number of magic books still being written, most magic is taught now via video, you know, like, and this is not, you know, that is how, you know, people are learning on YouTube, or they're learning on downloads, or, you know, for a while it was DVDs. And that really changes that learning experience, because you can be shown the secret and you can be shown exactly how to do it. And there isn't, you can pick up either intentionally or unintentionally the performing style of the magician who is performing it. Did you, in your research, find sort of some major differences between that kind of video instruction versus, you know, where you started with a book and a series of steps?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the interesting things about reading, for me anyway, the way in which I read, which may not be, you know, the way in which other people go about it, is, you know, I have this very kind of scanning technique, right? Where, I mean, that's the thing about the linearity of having to read, right? You can kind of move between, right? What you're reading, and kind of like, you know, is this, why is he, okay, I just want to go a little bit forward and figure out what this is about, or when are they going to give the punchline away, right? And you can do that in a way that's fairly kind of, you know, kind of easy with a written word. If you're video, you know, I mean, it's fascinating, of course, right? And it has, the thing about video, right, is you're able to show lots of different kinds of things at the same time. So you can have the patter, you can have the movements, right? You can have lots of positioning. I mean, that's all going on simultaneously. Very hard in a written text to have a lot of simultaneous actions taking place. I mean, you could do it. I don't know, you could have three columns or something like this, and, you know, divide it. but anyway, it's so the written out text is bad for, you know, being able to give that kind of fullness. But what it is good for is in being able to kind of have that kind of storyline that you can follow out. So, you know, for instance, with videos, I mean, one of the things you know, I would never really do, and I don't think I've ever done in a video, is try to kind of fast forward ahead to, like, see, okay, well, what are they going to talk about next? Or how is this description going? I mean, you don't do that in a video format. Where in a written format, you can see, okay, here's how they structured what they're going to say. I mean, I can get a sense of that just in a couple of seconds, just by, you know, kind of flipping through the instruction. I kind of get an outline for what's to come. But yeah, I think, you know, with videos, I mean, that's, you just kind of watch them through, right? I mean, you might go back to them, you know, of course, in all sorts of ways, but this kind of, there's a different kind of perspective that they give about what's to come. I mean, I've heard a lot of magicians talk about, you know, I mean, you know, very interesting comments. People like Ben Earle, he talks about the the limitations of written instructions as very productive and useful, right? Because then it requires this kind of active sense of you as someone trying to learn something. You know, you have to kind of engage with it, right? You can't, it demands a certain, you know, especially for, you know, kind of sleight of hand kind of based work, right? It demands your attention and your engagement. And for that reason, you know, you get more out of it in the end. Whereas video, you know, it's just easier, right? I mean, that's why so many people like video because it is. Mm. Right? And also this idea of, you know, through the video, right? I mean, you are positioned typically as this audience member, the way the cameras get set up, the angles, right? It's kind of, you know, a lot of these sort of video performances are done for you. And then you get that sense of seeing it, right? And I mean, that's very powerful, right? And then we see something and we, oh my gosh, that was amazing, right? And then we're hooked. With written instructions, you know, it's not that kind of engagement. So again, I mean, you know, many people argue that then demands that the magician, you know, think about these things in a way in which it doesn't happen within in a video context. I mean, I don't know how much any of that's, you know, I mean, it would be interesting to do some kind of research about that and to think about these different sort of, you know, ways of performing or sorry, these kinds of instructions to see if, you know, what do they enable and what they don't.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we had for, it was a very brief period of time, maybe kind of the early 2000s, was when DVDs were sort of at their height and you could go and it would be the routine, and it wouldn't just be watch a performance and the effect, but it could be broken down into sections, and I'm going to learn the Elmsley count, or, you know, I'm going to, what sort of deck of cards I should be using. And there was a sort of a lot of freedom there to actually choose how you're going to interact, you know, with the DVD. It makes me feel like there needs to be like a VR or almost like a gamified style of magic instruction where you can sort of, you know, like be fully immersive and
there's got to be lots of possibilities, right?
Yeah,
and we have, you know, we have such a wonderful art for you know, exploring how do you relate to what's shown to what's happening, you
know? So yeah.
There's got to be all sorts of spaces within that. And I think, you know, a lot of magicians, you know, who've gone online, right, and the kind of whole kind of turning to Zoom, that's been a, you know, a kind of exercise and then thinking about this sense of, you know, presenting to others through whatever the screen, you know, the screen that's in front of them, and, you know, for the context of explanation, but also for the context of just, you know, performances. And
yeah,
and magicians have come up with a lot of interesting kind of innovations for this. But yeah, just the final thing to say on, you know, I am struck, right, at how often there are effects that are, if you wrote them down and you just said, here's what you need to do, right, and someone read them, someone would be like, no, that's never gonna work. Yeah. Because so much of magic is based on kind of sensation and getting people emotionally engaged, and Danny D'Ortez, I mean that's his style of magic, right? I mean, he does things which you think he could never get away with. That there's no way, that's just not going to happen. You know, you know whenever you put four aces at the bottom of the deck and then you get people to, you know, to sort them out into four piles, and I mean, you know, he's got an effect where we have basically just, you know, people keep putting cards into four piles, which keeps messing up, and then at the end, you basically put the cards that have always been on the bottom the whole time, you put them on the top of four different piles, and then lo and behold, you kind of turn them over, and ta-da, you know, they're all the same.
Yeah, yes.
People have this sensation of like, oh my gosh, but we messed up the cards, and it's like, no, you were holding them in your hand.
Yeah, yeah.
The same cards are just, but you know, it has an effect for people. People are taken in by it and find it stirring and perplexing. But if you wrote that down, I mean, you know, It just wouldn't sound plausible.
British sketch comedy show, I think it was Not the 9 o'clock News, which I don't know if you're familiar, but yeah, back in the 80s, it was Rowan Atkinson, Ben Elton and those guys. And apparently Rowan Atkinson came in and said, I've got the funniest sketch. You're going to love it. It's great. And the sketch said, Rowan is walking down the street. He sees the camera. He turns and sees the camera and then walks into a tree. And that's it. That's the script for it. And when you watch it, it is exactly that. He just, Rowan Atkinson's boy, like, he sees the camera, gives a little smile, runs into a tree, not that hard, just soft, goes on with his day. And it's absolutely hilarious to the point where they did 3 or 4 more variations on it.
Yeah, well, sure, Mr. Bean, right? I mean,
Mr. Bean, exactly, yeah. You try and write Mr. Bean down. You know, it's not funny, but it's in the doing. And I guess it's that same idea of, and how we use language is that we have that sort of idea that I think it was Wittgenstein first kind of talked about, that I have a thought in my head and I want the thought, the same thought, to be in your head. And if I choose the right words, you'll have the same thought in your head as well. And we kind of assume that the best way to do that is by using as many words as possible. You know, like the more detail I can give you, the better it is. But often it's actually giving you just enough so you can discover it for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that relates to a lot of, you know, kind of ideas we have about objectiveness and so on. You know, just, I have to find the right labels to attach, you know, to whatever, to these actions. And if I can just do that, you know, but a lot of learning is not like.
So what's next for you then? It's, you think magic and education might be the next step?
Yeah, I'm definitely, you know, I've got some initial ideas here now that, you know, I'm pursuing Gustav Kuhn, who's a, you know, experimental psychologist. You know, he's someone who I'm working with now. And we want to try to take that forward and just try, you know, do some basic kind of work about, okay, well, how do you, how do you blend messages and magic? I think two for me, it's kind of more of a academic point, but I'm interested in the notion about revelation. So, you know, this comes back to a lot of the previous work I did. Take something like, I don't know, WikiLeaks, or, you know, this, just this whole idea of any kind of, you know, the idea that, you know, people are revealing information, right? We've got the secrets and, like, we're going to put them out. And I've been interested in that in lots of different spheres, in art and science and in politics and in magic. And so for me, I'm kind of interested in conceptualizing, what do we mean when we talk about revelation? It's been a lot of academic work about secrecy. How do we understand secrecy? You know, people thought about that, but really very little written about revelation as an idea. Maybe let's say outside of theology as an academic field. So one of the things I'm interested in, what is a reveal? How do we make sense of that as a term? Is it an act? Is it an outcome? Is it an impression on someone? I mean, there's all sorts of ways in which, you know, I think, can do kind of some basic work around that. But then the other, you know, the topic that I want to look at are these collective forms of fabrication that we're involved in. And I'm gearing myself up mentally to do a study of Father Christmas, the evidencing for Father Christmas. How do people, you know, how do parents or educators, others, you know, how do people convince children that Santa Claus exists? And then how to convince them that Santa Claus doesn't exist?
Yes, which is the really hard part. Like, is, you know, because I am at that stage at the moment of, I have a 9-year-old who is well aware of the whole deal, the whole situation. Yeah. You know, I know who they are. I know how smart they are. They know what's going on, but they have not uttered a single word to me out loud. It's like, you know,
so they're going along with it, right? At this stage, right? The Father Christmas myth is for your benefit, not for theirs, right? It's interesting, right? I mean, so you know, so there must be just a whole kind of, I think it's a fascinating topic because everyone has, you know, everyone who shares a certain kind of cultural, you know, sort of, you know, backgrounds and so on. I mean, there's a lot of people that have this kind of experience of going through this. So I think, you know, wouldn't it be fascinating to, I don't know, go to Lapland and and have a look around. I mean, what are people doing here? What are they expecting to see? I mean, there's a few magicians that play Father Christmas. During the holidays, right? I mean, it happens from time to time.
I'm getting closer and closer every year. Every year, just maybe 5 years ago, a kid said I look like Santa, and now I get it maybe 4 or 5 times a year, and it's a point at which the stomach to beard ratio is just going to be peak.
So go around. You go to whatever shopping malls or wherever Father Christmases are these days, and see, you know, what are audiences expecting from this? What are the experiences of people who do this? Anyway, I'm interested in how we build meaning together. And sometimes that's kind of jointly fabricated. You know, there's a lot of parties involved who are making the thing happen. And it's fascinating when that's a question of illusion or deception, right? So anyway, maybe I'll do that as a study, maybe not. But that's, I think, you know, it's one, this cooperating, you know, together in deception. It's certainly something that's come out of my work in magic. So we'll see. We'll see if I end up doing that as a next area of study.
As someone who works in education using magic every day, anything you can do to make my life easier, that's what I would really appreciate that. In the meantime, people can check out your book, Performing Deception. It's available everywhere. Also, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks for this opportunity.